Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. Now, last week we heard from the Mitchell Institute team and Audrey Brady, who is the Vice President for F-35 Global Sustainment at Lockheed Martin, about the latest with the F-35. After hearing about the F-35 from a pilot perspective earlier this year, we figured it was time to get input from those who build it. And I'm glad we did. If you took anything away from last week's conversation, it should really center around the complexity of the program. People make sweeping statements all the time, but at the end of the day, the airplane is comprised of thousands of sub-elements. Everything from how contracts are written to software and the various components. Taking a jet from theory to reality involves balancing all of these facets. Today, we're turning to the other major element that makes up the jet, the engine. We often take propulsion for granted, but the complexity of the jet is pretty eye-watering the more you learn about it. And the Pratt & Whitney F-135, which powers the F-35, is pushing the state of the art in really dramatic ways. And as I mentioned in the last episode, take note that the F-35 airframe and the F-135 engine are two separate contracts with the government. That's a powerful indicator that the engine isn't some simple bolt-on component. It stands alone as its own program. So to set the scene again, we have Major General Larry Stutzstream.
Hi, Slick.
Heather Penny.
Slick, hi. It's great to be back.
And Doug Berkey with us today.
Hey, Slick.
Now, guys, what were your main takeaways from our episode last week?
Well, I guess I'll start. It's crucial to understand that the F-35 isn't one massive single thing, and it's important to know this, especially for the sake of future weapon systems acquisition. The F-35 is an example of an evolving process of research, design, testing, initial production, more testing, and then the operational fielding, which requires a lot of concern about quality of maintenance and spares and so forth. So this all involves long-term thinking about sustainment of the overall enterprise. And too often we look at it like it's just one big thing, but that program and all its pieces is going to mature and evolve. And in the case of the F-35, it has matured a lot, but we need to be smart about regarding all the complexities. So I say, you know, evaluate the jet's maturity and performance accordingly. What we, you know, care about in the early years, early production, is way different than what we need to think about now that the jet is a major portion of the fighter fleet. Of course, it is time for the jet to deliver on the design promise, those promises of capability and affordability. But this is where we are at in the program, and it's happening. What Audrey said was encouraging, but clearly Congress and the services still need to be convinced.
You know, Stutz, it was interesting you mentioned sustainment. And one of the things that struck me was just the number of sustainment efforts that Lockheed Martin is working. You know, getting to the goal that the services want regarding availability and reliability isn't going to be a single solution. It's going to take a lot of small and discrete and focused efforts throughout the program. It was also interesting to hear her talk about major components of the program sunsetting and introducing new generations of technology. So think about Alice scaling back in favor of Odin. And this makes sense, right? Because we're going to have this jet for a long time. We can't be married to the technology of the past. If we stay welded to the program in a fixed fashion, F-35 will be obsolete. So it's good to see that they have the flexibility to be able to evolve the program, like Audrey discussed. And we have to be ready to continue to evolve it in order to be able to stay relevant. You know, it's also why we see some of those costs coming down. These fixes are working. So we said it, you know, before in the last episode, if you want to talk about the health of the F-35, so much of it is in the details. So people make sweeping statements about it. They're going to be missing the reality of it. It comes down to the details. It's about the nuts and bolts.
Now, I appreciate that from both you guys. And when I look at this, one thing that really struck me when Audrey is describing kind of what's in her job jar on a given day was the number of customers that she has to manage. I mean, you've got the individual services, the Air Force, the Navy, the Marine Corps, but then you've got over a dozen allied nations that are using this thing. And that's a lot of people laying on requirements all at the same time for a jet that's a moving target. And then you layer on the fact that each one of those countries is managing their own politics, their own budgets, operating circumstances, and all of that. And that is very, very complex. In a program like the F-16, I think we really developed the jet more in a fixed line of the Air Force in charge, and then really expanded it to a broader set of users and everything else. And obviously it wasn't a joint program at that point. This is everything all at once. And so I think that that is something that needs to be appreciated. It is what it is. We got to make it work, but it is a tough job. And so it's something that I think we need to keep in mind about who wants what, when, and the complexity involved with that. And the level of scaling here is pretty huge.
All right, got it. I really appreciate the comments there. And I've got to ask, what are your thoughts when it comes to the engine?
Let me jump into this first. People look at these fighter jets and they take propulsion for granted. And the jet is buried deeply inside the airframe, makes a lot of noise going down the runway, and you see the afterburners. They must all be the same, right? No. The F-135 is advancing propulsion technology and output to a level we have never seen before in the history of aviation. And so this is something that is pushing material science, physical performance, everything to the limits right now. And we've coasted on the F-110 and the F-100, the main engines are in F-16s and F-15s, for 40 years now. And they're mature products, have been mature products for decades. And people are used to a very notional level of sustainment and predictability and maturity. Guess what? The F-135 is totally different. Get over it. There's going to be a challenge, a learning curve. But guess what? It's going to get better, and it is going to level set, and it's going to deliver performance that we have to have. I mean, the F-35, the propulsion required for that jet to have the performance it needs is significant, and the power it needs to run all the systems and everything. That's a tall order. I'm confident we're going to realize the objective.
Yeah, Doug, let me, you talked about the complexity of the modern engine now and what's going on with that. And I have to kind of put this in perspective because I've been around these things. As you and I have talked about my past experience with accident investigations as a board president, I've been involved in three of those where we lost F-16s because of engine problems. These are very sophisticated engines. And, I think back when I was a kid, mothers could buy their children chemistry sets, which, were poisonous and toxic and dangerous. And I actually had a friend who had a working turbine engine that his dad put together. It was amazing, a turbine jet engine in his garage. Today, oh my gosh, I've seen engines disassembled, reassembled. I've been through the manufacturing process and through the maintenance process and through the depot process. And let me just, double hit what you said. These things are sophisticated. For example, in one accident where we lost an F-16, the causes of an engine flying apart and destroying the F-16 goes all the way back to depot, where an engine had gone through a periodic refurbishment, and certain components of that engine require, they're so perfectly milled that you have to cool one piece, warm up the other piece to get the spacing needed to push them together in a very aligned way. Well, there was a microscopic burr that resulted in a misassembling of that engine that over time just barely put the engine rotation off balance a bit, imperceptible, couldn't be picked up, but over time you had a fatigue that destroyed the engine. Peel that back and we find out that the training didn't exist. The type of people that were being hired at depot didn't have the skill set. So that was a huge period of time where the Air Force had to respond to that and fix that. Now you're looking at these state-of-the-art engines being pushed, state-of-the-art materials. Temperatures are higher. They require precise computer-monitored adjustments ongoing at all times. The requirement for making sure that depot training, the quality of people, having adequate spares, having well-designed and acquired spares from folks who know how to make these things and keep them in great shape. All of these things are at a level, and folks need to understand that that's going to cost money. It's going to cost manpower for both the training and the material as we go forward with these new engines.
You know, Stutz, what you said is absolutely correct. The technology, the materials, the designs, the tolerances are so tight, the materials so exotic that we really have to have the training and the maintenance and the depot to be able to make sure that the engines are healthy. And we also are going through a learning curve where we're seeing how these new designs in the F-135 are responding to adverse operational environments. And so we're learning some interesting things because we're putting materials in the engine that we haven't before, have not been in past engines, and so the engines are responding a little bit differently. So we've got a learning curve with this, and we have to understand that it's going to take a little time to figure it out and develop the appropriate fixes, modifications, and maintenance procedures. But, you know, folks need to understand that every engine goes through this kind of learning curve as we go through engine generational technology. So like the J-79 and the F-4 Phantom that you flew and my dad flew, right? My dad tells a story where they sucked in a turkey buzzard and blew it out the back. But the tolerances for the F-110 engine and the F-16 that you and I flew wouldn't accept something like that. So as you said, you know, when we first fielded the F-110 engine, there were a lot of learning problems. We were losing those engines quite a bit, and as a result, we were losing the aircraft. We're not losing aircraft with this engine, but we still have to understand that there's a learning curve, and people need to get that with every new development of generational technology. But one thing that we do need to keep in mind, too, is a lot of this is just down to basics. And it gets to what you said, Stutz, having the training for the maintenance line personnel, having the training in the right equipment in the engine shop, having the training in the right level of manning and the right capacity within the depots, making sure we've got the right number of spares. And I would say that to this point, we have not done that back to basics, foundational building blocks, due diligence for this engine.
All right, team, thanks as always. And with that, let's get on with part two. Today, we have two leaders from Pratt & Whitney's F-135 team. First off, I'd like to welcome Amanda Glode, Executive Director for F-135 Sustainment.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having us.
And Tim Picard-Forsythe, the Lead Integrator for the Combat Air Forces from Pratt & Whitney.
Happy to be here. Look forward to the conversation.
Now, many of the listeners may wonder why we wouldn't just have Audrey from Lockheed Martin speak to the engine, since it's an integral part of the aircraft. But here's the deal. Engines are different because of their complexity, their scale, and depth of integration necessary to support other systems on the jet, so much so that the government contracts separately with Pratt & Whitney for the F-135 engine, which powers the F-35. That means the government buys the engines directly from Pratt and provides them to Lockheed as government-furnished equipment. So if you want to know more about the engine, you need to ask the people building them. Now, let's establish for some context for our listeners, why is the F-135 engine totally different than almost any other military aircraft engine in service today?
Thanks for the question, Slick. It's a good one. I think covering all the answers to that question would take far more time than we have today, so I'll try to limit to maybe four or five things that I think that differentiate the 135. So to start with, it was designed for variant commonality so that it would be compatible with the overall Joint Strike Fighter program construct. As a result, it powers all three variants, and I think most of the population of your listeners probably know that. That was accomplished by designing in a modular architecture for the engine. There are five modules that make up the engine to provide operational advantages, and those come primarily through commonality of sparing, supply chain, repair network, things like that. It's also probably worth pointing out that the short takeoff and vertical landing variant, the STOVL, it has components that are unique to the F-35B. So staying on that thread for just a second, the STOVL line of discussion, if you think about your question overall, fourth to fifth gen, STOVL's made some serious progress. I've not had the pleasure of flying a fourth gen STOVL jet, but I know many who have, and they tell me that from a pilot perspective, the task loading and the risk was fairly intense. On today's F-35Bs, those issues are significantly reduced. conversion from conventional flight, which is mode one flight, to vertical lift flight, mode four flight, is amazingly simple. That's the direct result of some truly impressive integration between the air vehicle and propulsion engineers that did the design work. So hats off to that community. They leverage leading edge technologies and materials, and ultimately in the end kind of pulled off a miracle that revolutionized stovall operations. So that's one. Speaking of integration, staying on that thread for a second, it too is a key discriminator without doubt between fourth and fifth gen. So the F-35 mission, the offensive and defensive systems, the sensors, the weapons, the avionics, they all demand a high degree of integration between the jet and the engine. The best descriptor that I can think of that stands alone is probably symbiotic. At a foundational level, it's a really complex balance of resource allocation between the jet and the engine that allows the full suite of capabilities in the F-35 to come to the fight. So there are others, but one of the most notable is satisfying the overall requirements for thermal heat rejection or thermal demand. So this one's pretty obvious. Like his forefather, the F-119 that powers the Raptor, there's no doubt that development and sustainment of signature enhancing capabilities is unique to the 135. We won't dive into the weeds on that specific aspect here, but it's obviously a critical baseline attribute to any fifth-gen fighter. And from a pilot perspective, I guess I saved the best two for last. So one of the highest compliments I've ever heard from, you know, for as an engine provider from a pilot is that they rarely even had to think about the engine. The F-35 is controlled by two full authority digital engine controls. We call them FADECs. Think of the FADEC as the central brain or computing power for the engine. There are advanced control laws inside those FADECs that are combined with mechanical system redundancies that minimize the need for the typical care and feeding that you would have seen in the older jets in third generation and even some of the fourth generation jets. And so the last one, maybe I should have kicked it off with this one, is also pretty obvious, but I'll offer this out. It really is pushing more than 40,000 pounds of thrust. And as such, it's literally the most powerful fighter engine ever fielded that's operational. So to put that into perspective, between you and me, Slick, flying Vipers, that's a 30% increase in the power that we felt when we had the joy of flying the F-16s. So hopefully that gives the listeners some context of what makes the F-135 so different.
Yeah, I really appreciate that pick. And I tell you, I would love to put one of those in an F-16 and feel what it feels
yeah,
like in comparison.
That'd be right. Yeah, that'd be right.
That would be epic. But all right, Amanda, what about in terms of sustainment contract and support strategy? How's the F-135 different from legacy engine programs and why?
Thanks. Great question. So the F-135 sustainment structure is a bit different than many other programs, most predominantly because it has a global asset pool concept, meaning that no single customer can say that they own a serial number of a part, an engine, a module, et cetera, or support equipment, or most other elements of sustainment for the program. So everyone shares in that global pooling of assets, which means that there's pros and cons that come with that. So certainly the ability to reduce costs by that shared asset pool is a benefit that the entire program enjoys. But it does bring with it some challenges where you need to make sure that you're planning effectively for each of those individual constituents' needs, and the way that they're operating and utilizing the product can be different from one user to the next. Something else that's important to take into consideration, and Pick alluded to this during his opening, is that it's a modular design concept, meaning that there are some commonalities across the different variants of the engines that power the CTOL CV platform and the STOVL, which again offers some benefit in terms of being able to use modules across different platforms. That modular maintenance concept also means that we can bring modules into depot for maintenance instead of having to induct a full engine, which again means that those other modules that don't need maintenance at that given time can continue in operation, which should help with readiness as well as affordability of the program. Another element that's important to take into consideration on the F-135 is Many other military programs utilize a three-level maintenance concept where there's a certain amount of maintenance that's executed locally at a base or shipboard, another amount of maintenance that's executed at an intermediate shop, and then the most complex and comprehensive maintenance executed at a depot location, which can break the modules and assets down into the piece part levels. The F-135 has eliminated that middle layer of maintenance, most notably for affordability purposes. So that does require a little bit of different architecture in terms of capabilities that need to be inherent within the depot. And then again, some differences for the flight line as well. One element of this program in particular that, again, is different is other military programs typically would rely upon an engine readiness level or a different type of construct for a measuring stick of what availability needs to be in place. The F-35 program has focused on a mission capability level. And what that means is it's really a math equation of the number of aircraft that are in need of an engine and the number of available engines that can fly on any given day. So it's a simple evaluation of a numerator of the number of available engines and a denominator of number of aircraft that need an engine. And that's the readiness level that the program has been designed to support. And by that, I mean the amount of depot capacity, the amount of engines and modules available, the spare parts available, the manning, the entire program has been based upon this concept. It certainly has merits, and we're supporting it in a way that is meeting the contractual obligations, but recognize the fact that in some cases, there are different constructs that might be more applicable to what the user desires.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate that. And, you know, the program obviously was designed to be efficient and maximize affordability, but clearly there's something misaligned given that operators like the United States Air Force have had F-35 sitting on the ramp without an engine. And it really impacted, you know, especially the F-35 demo team's ability to fly air shows this summer. So what's Pratt & Whitney's solution to getting engines back into these jets and keeping up with demand? Any lessons learned or best practices from any other programs to draw from?
Sure. So the real elements of making sure that a program has the readiness that it needs come in three different forms. One is a focus on making sure that there's enough spare engines and modules available to meet the needs of the operators. A second is making sure that you have the right readiness and reliability measures in place and you're meeting those objectives. So the engines are staying on wing as long as you need and the components are operating as you've designed them to. And the third element is making sure that you have the right amount of maintenance capacity for this program. That would be the global depot network needed to bring modules back to service when they do actually need that maintenance. It's a real balancing act between those three different elements to make sure that you're achieving your objectives and results of readiness for the program. In a short period of time, any one of those can compensate for another that may have some challenges, but in the long run, your optimal solution for meeting your objectives and doing so in an affordable manner is having a balance across all three elements. So in particular for the F-135, we're meeting the reliability objectives for the program. The sparing ratios could be an opportunity to address, particularly relative to power module availability. But the challenge that the program's facing today really comes down to the fact that we're in a maturing phase right now for the depot infrastructure. So we're learning as we go, and we are building that capacity globally. And that's had an influence on our ability to make sure that enough modules are ready for each of the operators. And in particular, because of some of the removal drivers and the fleet size, the Air Force, unfortunately, has been bearing a lot of that brunt right now. In addition to incorporating the fixed hardware improvements for the hot section distress challenges, we're also collaborating with the JPO to develop increased limits to keep engines on wing. And by keep engines on wing, I mean keep engines flying so that they're not inducted to the depot for maintenance. So a big focus area is trying to, across the whole fleet, make sure that we are leveraging lessons learned. There's engine testing going on, there's field experience being gained, and any opportunities we have to keep the fleet flying, we're taking full advantage of in partnership with the JPO.
Well, Pick, we're going to call it as it is, and I know as two fighter pilots, we're going to treat this like the debrief, and so I hate to put you on the spot, but there is a perception out there that some of the engine isn't reliable. And I hear you about more spare parts and better training for people, and all of that made sense, but it also looks like there are just some core design elements at play here. And people point to things like blade coating wearing faster than anticipated in certain environments. What's your take on this, and how is the F-135 performing in the field in terms of reliability, and what steps are you taking to improve it?
Yeah, copy that, Slick. Yeah, thanks for the softball, man. Okay, so, we've heard loud and clear that what the warfighter needs is readiness. And without any ambiguity whatsoever, Pratt & Whitney deeply respects that need. We do. We also acknowledge our part in the readiness challenge that the customers are experiencing out in the field. So needless to say, in my role with Pratt & Whitney, I've had to think about this a good bit, right? Because I try to be the voice of the warfighter inside of Pratt & Whitney. So let's peel that perception piece back for just a second. I looked up the definition of reliability, right? It is the quality of being trustworthy or performing consistently well. That's the literal definition. You'll note in that definition, measurement of performance is an integral part of the definition itself. And Amanda was kind of alluding to that. So I thought it might be informative to reflect on some of those measures of merit that Pratt & Whitney is measured by for the 135. We use terminology that's called mean flight hours between removal. And propulsion guys put an E on the end of that engine. But it's effectively how often you have to remove the engine from the jet. Against that measure, the current production engine provides nearly 2 times that of the engine specification. Now, you can see that is out of balance with the expectation of the customer from a readiness perspective, right? Another measure of merit is how tough is the engine? It can take a licking and keep on ticking. I don't mean that in jest. It's ingested 70 foreign objects, including large birds, instrumentation, other types of debris, some of them you wouldn't imagine. And in each case, the engines continue to operate, allowing the pilot to get the jet back on the deck safely. Also, relative to fourth generation fighters, as a compare and contrast, it's demonstrated a 93% reduction in unscheduled engine removals. Now, we know that's all dissatisfying relative to what they're feeling in the field today. So you got to ask yourself, well, is the engine reliable? By the metrics of measure, it is. But there is a gap between the customer expectation of engine availability and the measures of reliability Pratt & Whitney has to deliver to, kind of back to Amanda's point. So I think that's the center of mass that's feeding that perception overall. And what it boils down to is that the sustainment structure and the readiness metrics haven't matriculated in unison with warfighter expectations. Quite literally, Pratt is being measured by the same non-mission capable metrics that were put in place in 2017. So reliability is by no means the only contributor to that readiness challenge. And Amanda alluded to those 3 pillars that she was talking about that have to all be there. But certain reliability is a player in the middle of that. And I think you're probably going to get into some more discussion about at least one of those things a little bit later.
All right. Well, I couldn't ask for a better segue than that because, Amanda, I've got to ask you a really tough question here. I'd like to dig into the blade coating issue some more because, as I understand it, it's a big issue that we'll see engine life improvement a lot. So what else can you tell us about this? Is there a fix in place, and how long will it take to field?
Sure. So we've observed through recent operations that the engines that are fielded have distress modes that are driven from exposure to high levels of calcium, magnesium, aluminum silicate, commonly known as CMAS. This is a challenge that's seen in hot, sandy environments. It's not unique to the F-135. It's not unique to fighter engines. This challenge has resulted in a delamination and some challenges with the thermal properties of some of the hardware in the hot section of the engine. We understand the drivers. We have a fix that's been fielded in the spring of 2020 that's been put in place in production as well as depot overhauls. We've got about a quarter of the fleet that has this improved coating and revised hardware installed in it, and we're aggressively working with the JPO to field this improvement throughout the entire fleet. It's tested and proven in other programs and similar environments. We've seen good progress to date in terms of how the hardware has been responding in this high CMAS environment. So we're confident that it's going to make a vast improvement in terms of readiness and availability related to the recent hot section distress-driven removals that we've seen on the fleet.
Well, Amanda, we've read a lot about backlogs at the depot where F-135 power modules are waiting to be inspected and repaired. And as I understand it, this is a major reason why aircraft are sitting on ramps without engines. Can you walk us through this issue and discuss what you're going to do to solve it?
Sure. Some of this gets back to those three pillars that we had talked about before. So to make sure that you're able to turn your modules around for maintenance in a fashion that meets readiness objectives, you need to have a depot capacity that's in place that's enabled to meet those maintenance needs and demands. So we're really focused on making sure that we're growing the capabilities across the global depot network. There's depots in the US and depots that are being set up internationally with the help of our partner nations. Admittedly, there's been some challenges in the road of development of that capability. We're certainly owning our portion of that and have made significant progress in terms of fielding support equipment to meet the depot capacity growth. We've made improvements in terms of the tech data that's made available to the depots. And we've also worked towards efficiencies and continuous improvement efforts to make sure that when questions are raised from a technical interpretation manner, that those are being addressed as quickly as possible. And we're leveraging lessons learned from our global depot network, specifically also taking into account learning that we had on the F-119 program and F-100 program and others that came before us to try and make sure that if there's process improvements, opportunities to partner differently with different organizations to speed resource responses to the actual maintainers, that we're doing the very best that we can. We've seen a vast amount of improvement in terms of the production numbers and our expectations of power module production for this year. We're on track to more than double the output of power modules from 2020 into 2021. We've seen great improvements in terms of the Tinker Air Force Base operations with our partner there. So the Oklahoma City Air Logistics Complex HMC partnership has significantly reduced the turnaround time. When we entered 2020, it was around 200 days or more in terms of power module turnaround. Our target's 120 days. They've been able to achieve that already for a certain number of power modules, and they're actually going to beat their output objectives for this year. So it's been a tough road, lots of lessons learned and improvements taken into account. Certainly a great partnership with all of the different depots and the JPO to make progress, but we feel that we're on the right path to helping the fleet with that increased capacity and being able to turn modules back to service to alleviate those AOGs.
Yeah, I appreciate your transparency and really diving into that, because obviously standing up those depot facilities around the globe is no small task. But I'm going to hit you with one more, and I apologize because I feel like I'm beating you up here. I know they're tough questions, and I appreciate it. But Amanda, let's talk about costs. And it's no secret that the services and Congress are demanding the F-35 costs, or that the F-35 costs less to operate. The engine is a major part of that equation. So how is Pratt planning to reduce its share of the sustainment costs?
Sure. So we are no stranger to cost reduction and affordability initiatives, whether it's on the military programs or our commercial programs, and appreciate the fact that affordable readiness is important to everyone. If we take a look at the F-135 specifically, the engine and the propulsion system makes up about 10 to 15% of the overall operating cost of the F-35. Acknowledging that we own the drivers for a vast majority of the ability to reduce that cost, we've taken a lot of things into account to try and focus on different portions of the life cycle, but I should probably describe those cost drivers a little bit before we get into the details. So if you look at propulsion maintenance, there's a small amount of fixed costs that are resident throughout the life cycle of a program, typically your manpower and other elements of that standing infrastructure. But the real driver of propulsion affordability and propulsion cost comes in the form of maintenance. So we're at the point in the program right now where we're still experiencing unscheduled maintenance, akin to oil changes, tire changes, et cetera, for your car. But when we get into the scheduled maintenance activities, which are driven by the design interval of the hardware that says at certain points along the life cycle, you need to bring the hardware in for maintenance. You have to replace a certain amount of it. You have to repair a certain amount of it. And this comes in waves based on the amount of time on the assets. Those are really the drivers for our costs. And those tend to happen in waves, if you will, that are based upon utilization and the delivery year of engines. So they're planned expenses. And as we get into the middle part of the 2020s, that's when we'll start our first big wave of scheduled maintenance on this program. And it will come and go, and we will have those sine waves of costs increasing, peaking, and then decreasing as we get through the first interval, and then it will repeat for the second. Our focus is really on trying to address those scheduled maintenance costs because they are the major driver. We've identified opportunities to reduce those scheduled maintenance costs for the first scheduled visits that we'll be seeing by about 36%, and we're not resting there. We'll continue to try and find other opportunities to drive down part replacements, to expand limits, to repair more parts and avoid part replacements where we can, and focus on any amount of cost reduction for those scheduled maintenance activities, leveraging, again, lessons learned from other programs, as well as the unscheduled visits that have come into the shop so far.
All right. Well, Pick and Amanda, I can't say thanks enough for your time to be on the Aerospace Advantage. And we know that you and your team are really pushing the state of the art. We can't thank you enough for that. Obviously, delivering a great, reliable engine for the F-35 to the warfighter. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of Pratt & Whitney.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.